Good afternoon. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. And this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 261. It's March 21st, 1977. Last week when I mentioned my suspicions about weather control and the elimination of the dams project by Jimmy Carter, I didn't mean that the location of the dams that were to be built were necessarily the best locations. Some of them were damaging to Indian property and other property, but what I meant was that I considered very serious that at the height of a drought and a time period where the governors from as many states were meeting to consider the problem of these droughts that were affecting this country, that Jimmy Carter made a blanket dismissal of these dam projects. There were 19 major irrigation projects in the offing, and when he ran for president, he did announce that he would eliminate some of them. But this was a big elimination of many, many millions of acres and many millions of wheat that would grow, and we need the farming jobs, and there are places where the dams would be useful. There's an example in South Dakota where the farming area, if it had the dams, there are 500,000 acres that could provide drinking water for 17 cities and towns and provide benefits for the people there. But by eliminating these dams at the insistence of a handful of farmers, it puts the entire state in jeopardy. It would be like several farmers in Flinders Valley deciding that they can have water and that other persons can't have water for small farms and projects. And I've studied the weather modification from Nazi Germany, the ability to control our weather from the satellites, and the ability to cause droughts, to cause snow, to create snow, and to use these droughts for purposes of eventual famine. I don't want to go into it at length today, but it is a subject that I could do an entire program on. And I feel it's very dangerous when a farmer from Georgia, who isn't hurt by the weather modifications, begins to alter a state such as California or the West, Idaho, Iowa, Nevada, New Mexico, South Dakota, the Midwest, and they're getting these severe droughts, and the East are getting their severe snowstorms. I think you could compile, which I've done, a strong case for believing that an investigation should be made into why we're not looking to the future to utilize water so that the most amount of citizens get a fair shake at the available water. Another subject that I briefly touched last week was on the ban of saccharin, and I talked about my suspicions about the way it was taken off the market with such haste. And after that program on Dialogue Conspiracy, the next day in the New York Times, there was in the Wall Street stock market section, there was an article called Action in Sweet Stocks, and it said the jitters rattled the stock market yesterday, but sugar-related issues managed to go up. There was a burst of buying. Thursday proved a buoyant session for sugar-related stocks in response to the proposed ban on saccharin. Gains were registered by Holly Sugar, Amstar, Amalgamated Sugar, and Great Western United States. Similarly, the major soft drink issues, notably Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, produced brisk price rebounds after their weakness in early sessions. Considering that Jimmy Carter was put in with close associations with the Coca-Cola people, you remember Richard Nixon was called the Pepsi-Cola president, Jack Anderson wrote an article about whether we were electing Pepsi-Cola or Coca-Cola into the White House, the Attorney General, Mr. Bell, is the lawyer for Coca-Cola, one of the largest offices in the United States. It happens to be in Georgia. The Coca-Cola people have supported Jimmy Carter. He's known as the Coca-Cola president. And therefore, it seems very strange that he's in office just 2 months. All of a sudden, the dosage would be the equivalent of 7,000 diet colas given to a rat could possibly cause cancer is excuse to take saccharin off the market this time. And if you turn to the back pages of your Wall Street Journal and your New York Times, you see that the stock market goes up and the sugar rally went up really high. That's interesting because I'm sure the diabetics wouldn't use the sugar anyway, but people who don't have diabetes, like myself and many other people who do like these products, will be deprived of them. And the sugar industry is hopping again and the stocks are going up. And of course, in the same article, it goes on to say that IBM moved up last week and we're selling thousands of shares, and that's interesting because we know Jimmy Carter's cabinet is stacked with directors from the IBM company. One other matter I did want to talk about briefly was WBAI in New York. We've talked about it on Dialogue Conspiracy before. the controversy they had over free programming and programs such as Dialogue Conspiracy and how it was taken off the air, and then the controversy of new station managers being brought in and firing the people that had this type of talk program going. Well, BAI is off the air now, and the seven people who were fired for having free speech programming were now put in jail. They're in jail now, or were arrested this week because they didn't want to leave the station. They had it in a semi-state of siege. But I got the background on the program director who was partly responsible for all these firing. His name is Pablo Yoruba Guzman, and he, when he was younger, was a member and organizer of the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican group in New York City. And I got the application, the job application, a resume of Mr. Guzman, and the important thing about him, besides his training in Mexico City with Ivan Illich, the director of an institution down there, and his large minuses of years where he doesn't explain where he was, and his time period in his resume is filled with all kinds of question marks. He worked at one time with IBM, then he worked with McGraw-Hill, the publisher. But the interesting thing is that he evidently didn't go in the Army during the war and was put in the federal prison in Tallahassee in 1974 and then completed his parole. It was under the two counts of selective service violation that he was put in this federal prison in Florida. But he said in his resume, "I was paroled from Tallahassee February 74 and completed parole by May 75. For reasons unknown to me, as I didn't apply for it, I received a pardon from Gerald Ford in February of 1976. I helped found the Young Lords Party." Now that's pretty interesting that Mr. Guzman was getting a full pardon from Gerald Ford in 76 and then goes on to WBAI to become station manager to change the format so that they have no more talk shows and discussions of the conspiracies or about Rockefeller or the Trilateral Commission and that type of programming. They're bringing in salsa music instead. Gerald Ford pardons this gentleman, and he goes on then to BAI to become the director. And one of the references he gives for the job is Geraldo Rivera from WABC News TV, who's one of the most deliberate cover-ups of the conspiracies in the news media, along with Dan Rather and Cronkite and those other creeps. Well, I want to talk a little bit about James Earl Ray and what he might or might not be telling the investigating committee that's going to see him this week. It is quite a precedence. The convicted assassin, James Earl Ray, who was charged with killing Martin Luther King, is going to submit to questioning by members of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And James Earl Ray's attorney is allowing this to take place. He had to get rid of two attorneys who had associations with the CIA in order to get a new attorney to allow him to tell his story. Ray claims that he did not shoot Martin Luther King. The U.S. Justice Department just recently released a report saying that he was the lone assassin. And James Earl Ray is going to have an opportunity to talk before the committee, and this is quite a sensible thing to do, but it's a very sensitive project to do. He's willing to testify before the House Congressional Committee, but how much he can tell is a very iffy line, because you remember he is a prisoner and it's like walking a tightrope line. James Earl Ray was on television the other night with Dan Rather with an interview, and he compared himself to Valachi. Valachi was a member of the organized crime syndicate who gave himself up in exchange for protection. He was going to tell the federal government about the links and connections of organized crime. And he was given a special penthouse at Sing Sing, and he was put in a special protection unit, and a book came out telling about his life and the crime syndicate. And then after he told what he had to tell, instead of giving him a release and sending him to another country, they put him back into prison in the general population, where he was immediately killed, and the government did not protect him. So James Earl Ray is going to talk to the federal investigators, at least the House Representative Committee, before he comes to Washington. Before he testifies, you have to remember that Sam Giancana was murdered before he testified at Senator Church's committee. John Roselli was murdered after he testified at the committee. Sheffield Edwards of the CIA, who hired Giancana and Roselli, was murdered after the two men were murdered. William Harvey of the CIA, who supplied the weapons for Giancana and Roselli for the job of allegedly trying to kill Fidel Castro, was then murdered this last summer, just a month or two after he testified before a Senate committee. Jimmy Hoffa has testified before no committees. He has been murdered. He's disappeared, and for all purposes, murdered, like Mr. Bramlett, whose body was found last week. And you have Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald, Guy Bannister, and literally hundreds of people involved with this being murdered. So when James Earl Ray said on national television that he compared himself to Valachi, you have to leave open the possibility that he isn't going to tell you everything, because if he tells you he was involved in a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King, then some very anxious black agents, even inside the prison, could then murder him immediately on the excuse of vengeance for King's death. He is in a Tennessee jail, so you know that he is subject to being harassed by the whites or the blacks. Racial overtones could be a good cover story, so how much can you tell? There are things I would like the Congressional Committee to ask him, but I haven't been able to contact Mr. Sprague or the committee. And there's a good reason why I can't, because they don't want these questions, and I do not get my mail through to them. I've tried, and I have the phone number of Mr. Sprague. He doesn't call back. But the questions I would ask James Earl Ray would be, first of all, about his escape from the Missouri jail. He sat in a cell with a man named Mr. Bridgman, who said that at the time they were both in this Missouri jail, there was a conversation about killing Martin Luther King, and that $1 million would be given to somebody who would help kill Martin Luther King. And shortly after that, James Earl Ray made a miraculous escape from the jail, and the warden cooperated by not giving the FBI, after he escaped, the right fingerprints or the right identification. And the warden didn't look for James Earl Ray for 24 hours. There was no notice to the police, the neighbors, or anyone in the community that this gentleman was missing from a cell check. The warden, I understand, was a lawyer in the Bay of Pigs operation and could possibly have worked with E. Howard Hunt or many of the Anacostia Cuban community in the Southwest, because he was involved in that particular operation. The day before James Earl Ray left that Missouri penitentiary, his brother came to visit him. His brother works for Mr. Stoner of the States Rights Party, the Nazi party in the Southwest, and the next day Ray escaped. Ray arrived in Illinois with a full alias, Social Security card, a new name, and he was ready to travel. The fact that nobody has associated that with his brother or his brother's visit or with the warden letting him out hasn't come up in any of the investigations in the last few years. And then James Ray went on to Montreal. First he went to a trailer, and very conveniently the trailer was open, the door was open the first night. He made a convenient resting place for himself. There was wine, I understand. It had been raining, and maybe there was a change of clothes. There were trailers available for Donald DeFries when he left Soledad, right outside the Soledad, that were used for marital meetings that he had used. And James Earl Ray was able to leave the prison. There was no alarm for these 24 hours. He stayed in a trailer, and then he wended his way to many places. And I thought maybe in a few minutes I'd run down some of the places where he was, because I don't believe that the investigators are going to in any way cover this, and yet it's the breadth of the investigation that is important, because whoever provided James Earl Ray with the $10,000 he spent is not known to James Earl Ray except for a man by the name of Rowell. But who made the IDs, who made the social security numbers, and who provided him with the passports is more important, and it's those people that should be called, the people that gave him the passports, the offices, and on what basis he appeared and what documents he showed in terms of birth certificates to do his traveling and his wandering. But his experiences were interesting. In 1967, April 22nd, 1967, he got a visit from his brother John at Missouri State Penitentiary at Jefferson City. April 23rd, he was missing from Missouri State Penitentiary. From April 23rd to 29th, he went across the river to Kansas and then to St. Louis, where he called a friend, and then he caught a bus to Chicago. On April 30th, he stayed in Chicago, and then he used the name John Larry Raines, R-A-Y-N-S, and his Social Security number and his card, he had a full card and identification, was 318-24-7098. And he stayed in a rooming house there until June 25th. He ran an ad in the paper in the Chicago Tribune and got a job in a restaurant in Winnetka, Illinois, and he did pretty well. He was just out of prison, and he made $107 a week, which is a little over $400 a month, and he worked there. His brother, Jerry Ray, worked 10 miles away from him at this same restaurant. He was making $400 a month, and his brother, Jerry, was 10 miles away, and his sister, Susan Ray, was very near, and he was described as industrious, sober, neat, and quiet. Then he brought a Chrysler from a private owner. He saw an ad in the paper. He got a temporary driver's license. He visited some friends in St. Louis. He sold the Chrysler, and he bought a Plymouth. Then he traveled by way of Indianapolis, and he went into Canada. He went to Toronto, and during Canada, Montreal. And then he signed a 6-month lease at an apartment there, $175 he put down in advance for 2 months' rent. Then he went to the Tip Top Tailors in July of 67 and fitted himself with suit and slacks and shirts and swimming trunks, socks, underwear, pajamas, spent several $100 on his clothes. Then he was fitted with another suit that was mailed to him to Birmingham, Alabama, and he stayed at a hotel. He had manicures and services at the hotel, and went to a bar called Neptune Bar in Montreal, where he met Raoul, R-A-O-U-L. And Raoul then made arrangements to meet him in the South. He claimed that he did some smuggling for Raoul between Canada and Detroit. He sold his Plymouth in Chicago in August, took the train to Birmingham, Alabama, checked into a hotel there, opened a safe deposit box, received a letter, and then there was $2,000 cash, and he bought a new Mustang, and he kept one set of keys, and Raoul kept the other. Later, there are controversies about the Mustang, because one had an automatic shift, and the other one was a standard shift, but he had this $2,000 waiting for him, and he took a driving test, and he stayed in Birmingham. In September 67, he took some dancing lessons, he had his eyes fixed, and he took a course to be a locksmith, and he got his license plate, 1968 license plate, and he sent a money order to a film company. He bought a Kodak projector and a movie camera, zoom lenses, splicers, remote control cable. It doesn't say where he used his camera, what kind of pictures he took, but he bought a lot of expensive camera equipment and with this money that he had. And then he had manuals on sound strippers and Land automatic cinema printers. He had projectors, and there was no explanation of what he did with that. In October, he went to Mexico, to Nuevo Laredo, and he went over the border, and he met Raoul at a motel there. He stayed in Acapulco one night. He was in Guadalajara and Puerto Vallarta for 19 days. That's a nice little vacation. He spent 3 weeks in Puerto Vallarta, and then another week there, and then he went up to Los Angeles and rented a room on North Serrano and stayed there a while. He enrolled at a dance studio and took dancing lessons, and then he left for New Orleans. And he drove to New Orleans. This is the path that Louis Lomax tried to duplicate, and as the black newspaper writer, and he's a writer well known, and James Earl Ray had told him, or put in detail, that path. And Louis Lomax was to go to New Orleans to meet Jim Garrison, the district attorney there who had prosecuted Clay Shaw with regard to the John Kennedy assassination. And it was at this on this route, duplicating Ray's route in Houston, Texas, that Lomax's car went off the road and he was murdered. I think it's murdered. The car just spun over for no apparent reason, and he was killed, and that was the end of Louis Lomax trying to duplicate the route of James Earl Ray. But James Earl Ray went on through New Mexico and then went to the French Quarter near the Trade Mart in New Orleans, and he was on Canal Street where he met Raoul, and it seemed to be the same address where Lee Harvey Oswald had picked up money just a few years earlier in 1963, in the summer of 1963. So the Trade Mart was the building that Clay Shaw was managing, the International Trade Mart, in 1967 in New Orleans. He left New Orleans again in December of 67 to go to Los Angeles. Then he wrote to the South African Council in Washington, D.C. He was getting ready to move to Rhodesia and wrote to them that he wanted to go there. By January, we're into 1968 now, he moved to the St. Francis Hotel This is very interesting because he had no real use for his photographic equipment. There's no evidence of the pictures he took. He was provided with a car and these various routes, and he just seemed to be traveling and taking dancing courses and locksmith or whatever and just dawdling around. He had no purpose for doing all these things and no apparent purpose. But then January the 4th, he visited what was called the self-improvement specialist, Reverend Xavier von Koss. And nobody's done heavy research on Reverend von Koss to find out who in the heck he is. He's supposed to be the head of what is known as the International Society of Hypnosis. And there James Earl Ray got three books recommended to him: How to Cash In on Your Hidden Memory Power, Self-Hypnotism, and Psycho-Cybernetics. And these three books were in the luggage of James Earl Ray when he was arrested in London. And this is very interesting because hypnosis was an important part in the role of Jack Ruby when he killed Lee Harvey Oswald right after the Kennedy assassination, and with Sirhan Sirhan when he was in the Ambassador Hotel. And James Earl Ray, and one of the many patsies or alleged assassins, was used or hypnotized. And there is this Reverend Xavier von Koss, head of the International Society of Hypnotists. January the 19th, he went to another school of bartending and took his course there, evidently interested in that. February, he put an ad in the Los Angeles Free Press, signed by Eric S. Galt. Now, Eric S. Galt, Eric Starvo Galt, was his other alias. He used Rains, and he used Galt, and he used Mr. Sneed and Mr. Bridgman, and he had proper ID for all of these. He put an ad in there for a swingers club to meet some women, and then he had his Mustang near the Capitol Hill's home in... This was in February in Birmingham. It was traced to the Standard Oil service station in Birmingham that he was there in February. And two station attendants said that he was in Birmingham, Alabama in February 1968. But they fixed his clutch. That they had trouble with the clutch trouble. And they said the Mustang was automatic. But actually it had a standard shift, the one that he had. So there is this discrepancy because on the records of what was done at the station, when he went to the Standard Oil station in Birmingham, they fixed the automatic, and the other didn't. They have on the record the clutch trouble, but his Mustang was automatic. From there, he went to a plastic surgeon, a Dr. Russell Hadley, to have the tip of his nose fixed and the drooping left ear. And that's interesting because another double of his, after he got out, he used the name of Mr. Bridgman, and a gentleman that he was in the prison with in Missouri also had the name Bridgman. But the Bridgman who traveled between Montreal and Florida had surgery done identical to some other surgery that James Earl Ray had done, so that they would both look like each other. And these are the iffies and questions that I'm sure the House Committee won't have time to go into or won't even consider, but they make the story so complicated and gross, and each thing is important in itself, the surgery and the doubles and who created the doubles, because there were doubles of Sirhan Sirhan and Lee Harvey Oswald and James Earl Ray, and so it's important to know how these doubles came about, and also Donald DeFries, and only the federal government can do those things. A man like Rowell can give James Earl Ray $10,000 and tell him where to travel, or a man like George Zimbornchel can give Oswald instructions on where to travel, but the conspiracy doesn't begin or end with Rowell, and all James Earl Ray knows is Rowell. So that is the important part about this story, or all these other people, it should be called. Well, he went to this plastic surgeon and had the tip of his nose fixed, and the before pictures that the doctor had that they usually keep were destroyed, of course, by faulty camera, and his left ear was fixed, drooping left ear. Somebody called on March the 1st the Alabama Highway Bureau in Montgomery, Alabama, and they wanted a duplicate driver's license for an Eric Starvo Galt, Eric S. Galt, and they asked that it be mailed to Alabama into Birmingham, and the duplicate was mailed, and there was a charge of that. So somebody else besides James Earl Ray was getting this other name, Eric Galt, to the same driver's license. Two people had copies where James Earl Ray wasn't ordering it, somebody else was. And the gentleman at the bureau, Mr. Chirpy, said he didn't know who picked up the duplicate, but it was picked up. And on March the 2nd, he graduated from a bartending school in Los Angeles. March the 5th is when he had the tip of his nose removed by Dr. Hadley. March 7th, the 11th, he went for post-operative treatment. by Dr. Hadley. Now, it would be interesting to do research on Dr. Hadley to find out if he had any use of hypnosis on James Earl Ray, because many surgeons are known as hypnotists. I know of some, in fact, I got a letter this week about somebody regarding a law case, and they needed a hypnotist to come in and find out the truth of the matter, and the hypnotist was a surgeon. So it'd be interesting to know if Dr. Hadley in Los Angeles was really treating James Earl Ray for surgery, or whether the hypnotism was coming into him, because this was in March. And did he really have the ear fixed? And the before pictures aren't showing, so we don't know. And it'd be interesting to know what he did and get him to testify, because he was in the office several times for the surgery and for the post-operative treatment. On March the 9th, Gault was supposed to have phoned and turned down a bartending job. He graduated from bartending school and used the name Gault and then turned it down. And March the 15th, Ray got a letter from Rowell and told him to come back to Atlanta, Georgia. And so he gave his change of address to Atlanta, Georgia, and he departed from California March 17th and went directly to New Orleans first. He arrived there in March, and then Selma, Alabama, March the 22nd. And then he drove from Selma to Birmingham, and then to Atlanta, and he rented a room in Atlanta for a short while, from March 25th. Now, Mr. Gault, Eric Gault, was James Earl Ray, and Rowell drove to Birmingham, Alabama, where they registered at a travel lodge and bought a high-velocity rifle at a supply place near the airport. On March the 30th, the next day, they exchanged the rifle that they bought for a similar one, and the salesman remembered them. The first one was supposed to be faulty and wouldn't fire, and then they returned to Atlanta. He paid rent for a whole week to Mr. Garner, but he wasn't seen around there much. And then he departed from Atlanta in a Mustang, April the 1st. April the 2nd, James Earl Ray went to Corinth, Mississippi, where he was supposed to have practiced with his new rifle on the side of the road off of Highway 78. It would be interesting who saw him there with that rifle. April the 3rd, he got some drug equipments and registered at the Rebel Motel in Memphis, Alabama. Now, James Earl Ray had never been in Alabama, in Memphis, Tennessee, rather, in his life. He left Alabama and went to Memphis, Tennessee, and he had never been there before in his life. So he went there, and that was April the 3rd. Then, on April the 4th, he changed from the Rebel Motel to the rooming house at 422½ South Main Street in Memphis, under the name of John Willard. And the landlady there said that this room was rented to John Willard. He bought some binoculars, and he was supposed to have been at the rooming house at the time that Martin Luther King was killed. Now, Martin Luther King was staying at another hotel, the Holiday Inn, and he had been harassed or ridiculed for staying at a so-called white man's hotel, so he changed his reservations to the Lorraine Motel. The Lorraine Motel was directly behind the alley to the rooming house where James Earl Ray had checked in, but he had been instructed by Rowell, and he claims that he wasn't in the rooming house at the time Martin Luther King was killed, but he did get in his car and make a fast getaway. Somebody in the rooming house took a rifle and the binoculars, wrapped them in a blanket, and left them on the street right outside, which seems a funny thing to do if somebody's going to assassinate Martin Luther King. You'd think you'd at least hide it or take it with you if you're going to make a getaway, and the police conveniently let him make this getaway, and James Earl Ray was ready to leave the area. He left in a Mustang April the 5th, and he was able to make a trip then. He said he went to Mexico. He arrived in Cincinnati at 1:30 a.m. then April the 6th. The Mexico trip was iffy. He told somebody he went to Mexico, but he wasn't in Mexico. Later they checked out that he actually was in Cincinnati, and then he went from Atlanta by bus and stayed over there, and then went to Detroit April the 6th, and went to a train station, cleaned up, and took a cab to Windsor, Canada, and then went to Toronto. And then he made some miraculous trips. He got passports in Canada. He applied for a birth certificate April the 10th. This was very convenient. It was delivered to him under the name of Bridgman. And then he had passport photos under the name of Bridgman. Then he went to a theatrical supply place and bought a disguise kit for his trip. And he was in Toronto also using the alias of Mr. Sneed, S-N-E-Y-D, and he had somebody visit them. There was an envelope left for him, and he had some contacts, and the passport under Sneed was it was in the files June the 1st. It was discovered that he also had a passport under that name. April the 19th, he took a room at Notre Dame West in Montreal. He checked the ships. He needed a passport, so he went back to Toronto, and he cased the Toronto area, and then he flew to London. He got an airplane ticket and flew to London and was there overnight, and then flew to Lisbon and stayed at the Hotel Portugal in Lisbon, and he was supposed to be there several nights. He visited several cafes, including one called the Texas Bar and one the California Bar, and then he went to the Canadian Embassy and changed his passport on May the 15th from Sneed, S-N-E-Y-A, to S-N-E-Y-D, and left Lisbon and went to London by air, and he was supposed to be going to Rhodesia. He went back to London for some strange reason and checked in at a hotel in London, and there was a man with him when he checked in the hotel. He went to the New Earl's Court Hotel in London, and the receptionist said that he was in the company of another person. That was May 28, 1968. And he left there with his luggage for the airport. He was flying out that night. He was making conversation with people about the murder of Robert Kennedy. He was sarcastic. This was June the 5th when Robert Kennedy was killed, and it seemed that he was on his way to South Africa. He was anxious to go to South Africa. June the 5th, he appeared with a man, it seemed to be a blonde man, who was with him at the Pax Hotel, but James Earl Ray was picked up by Scotland Yard, and he was then extradited to the United States. Well, that is quite a lengthy discussion of the travels of James Earl Ray, but I purposely went into the details of some of it for you because you can see how complicated it's going to be and how little he's going to really be able to tell. I'm sure the Congressional Committee could ask the officials in Montreal how he got these various passports, ask his brother if he, under oath, sworn testimony, if he brought him that security card, identify the trailer, the person who owned the trailer, where he stayed overnight, and call that person in, the people in Illinois that housed him, where he worked these months before he left, and he was getting phone calls and meeting people there. You could call his family in and put them under oath about the contacts of James Earl Ray in that Illinois period. And then, of course, the trips to Mexico were interesting, and his Los Angeles trips and his constant traveling. I think the purpose of all this traveling is to make it so complicated that it does become almost impossible to unravel. You could say he was doing dope dealing, and that's how he got the money. You can say it was a payoff, you know, for his role of being the patsy, that he was used. I believe he was used continuously and knew that there was a big pot at the end of the rainbow if he did all the right things. And so far, he's done all the right things. He said on television, "I figured if I pleaded guilty at the time of my trial, I could produce the evidence later, and then I could get out on the basis of a new trial, and that I didn't have the right to a fair hearing last time." And that is true, and it may be that he just sat there waiting. It was Percy Forman, his attorney, who told him to plead guilty at the time of his trial and not get a death penalty and bide his time. And maybe that was the agreement, because Percy Forman had told other client, in the case of H.L. Hunt, the oilman in Texas, spend time in jail, you'll get $1,000 a week, and when you get out, you'll be paid off and serve your time. It's a hard way to do it if James Earl Ray sits in a cell for 8 or 10 years and he's isolated and he's protected from the prison population. He has his television. Is there that so-called $1 million that I heard about from Credit Suisse, Permandex Foundation, waiting for James Earl Ray? Is there a pot at the end of the rainbow that he will ever get out and be extradited and maybe get to a place like Rhodesia and feel that he spent 10 years in prison and now his money is waiting for him there? That's a good question. Or will the federal agents murder him and keep the money, which they've done before? They've made deals with people similar to the movie The Borgia Stick, if you ever saw that, where they did their assignments. And then when they were ready for their passports and for the payoff for what they had done, they were to go to another country. This couple were told to go into a hospital to get some face surgery so they wouldn't be recognized and so that their face would match the passport picture. And all they had to do was go one more hospital and they were home safe. And then when they were put in the hospital, which was run by the CIA, They had lobotomies and psychosurgery. Their brains were removed. The agency could keep the $1 million, and the agents were turned to vegetables. This does happen. I've talked to a man who has worked for the CIA who told me it does happen, exactly like in the movie. So Ray is in a precarious position. I don't know whether there's an advantage to say anything, because in 1 hour he can be killed by anyone in the prison and the mystery goes on. But I think from the description, the chronology, and that's just a quick rundown, you get a pretty good idea of the complication of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And there are many people in the Southwest, Atlanta, Georgia, and I want to go into this at length on another program, who are naming specific people as being involved in the transaction of killing Martin Luther King, that were the money people behind Rowell. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to James Earl Ray when he goes before that committee. There was a news item last week that I want to talk about just for a few minutes, and then I'll talk at length more about it next week on KLRB. There was a news item on CBS this last week that only one person that I know heard. She happened to be up working all night on a project and heard the CBS news, and it had to do with one of my most favorite of all people called George de Morenschild. And it was the CBS News, March 16th, 1977, at 7 in the morning. And if any of you see any news articles about this, send them to me. If you heard any other programs, let me know. Because it had to do with a Mr. Altman, a Dutchman, who was a close friend of George de Morenschild. And he went to Brussels with de Morenschild a few months ago. And de Morenschild said to him on that trip, "What would you say if I told you I was responsible for all the acts that Lee Harvey Oswald did, that I was responsible?" He said de Morenschild told Altman that Oswald had worshipped him, which I doubt. He said Oswald would do anything de Morenschild told him, which I believe. And the point of the CBS story was that George de Morenschild is missing. He's mysteriously missing, and I called Penn Jones in Texas, who studies the people that are missing and knows where de Morenschild is. He's supposed to be teaching at the university there, and George de Morenschild and his wife have taken a powder just at a time when the Congressional Committee is going into the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. George de Morenschild has left, and he left quickly out of Texas the same week that another important witness, Paul Rygotarodsky, died. Now, that leaving and the death may be coincidental, and it may not, but this is terribly important. Who is George de Morenschild? Those of you that have read anything on the Kennedy assassination or heard any of my lectures on the subject know that out of the 552 witnesses of the John Kennedy assassination, de Morenschild, in my mind, is the most important witness. It's almost impossible to describe him in 2 or 3 minutes. The Warren Commission used de Morenschild to create the fictitious Lee Harvey Oswald, the story of introducing him to the white Russian community that made up the story that Lee couldn't hold a job, that there was no meaning in life, that he was jealous of the rich. De Morenschild set up a group of agents from the military intelligence and refugee group called the Solidaris, the white Russian community, to create the profile Lee Harvey Oswald as a ne'er-do-well, where he was actually a very brilliant and skilled person. And the importance of de Morenschild in terms of history, of our times, is that Oswald had skills, and these are facts. Oswald knew electronic work. He worked in a radio shop in Russia 2 years. He knew microdotting and photographic film. He worked on radar, high-up security clearance in the military, U.S. military, in the Marines. And he, with his electronic training, his radar training, his language skills, he was an accomplished person by the age 22. He had mastered a very complicated language. These are facts. Our history is riddled with misinformation, and which I call propaganda, as against facts. And de Morenschild spread propaganda about Lee Harvey Oswald. And if it would sell, the important thing was that if it sold, then you could use the same propaganda against any other operation, whether it was the story about Sirhan Sirhan or Arthur Brammer or James Earl Ray, the alleged assassins, or the people that kidnapped Patty Hearst, the creation of the SLA. Once you get a psychological profile, whether it's Donald DeFries or any of these people, based upon lies and not facts and not really linking them to the police agencies, you get a distorted picture of history. And it was de Morenschild who placed Lee Harvey Oswald in a photographic lab in Dallas area called Jagger's Chili Stovall, that did work for the U.S. government printing office, that printed bonds. Some men needed security clearances there. It was de Morenschild who introduced Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, to Ruth Payne, who called Mr. Roy Truly at the Texas School Book Depository and said, I have a woman here whose husband needs a job. It doesn't matter whether the anti-Castro Cubans, the oil people, the CIA want to kill John Kennedy or the syndicate because he didn't go and invade Cuba for the syndicate or the oil people, or whether the nuclear test ban treaty, whatever the reasons were for killing Kennedy, and a lot of people in power had a lot of reasons for killing him. Only by bringing the car in front of where Kennedy would be could the assassination come. And it had to be on Lee Harvey Oswald because there were 20, 30 people introduced to Oswald by de Morenschild who would create this fictitious personality. And it's the fiction that the researchers, and particularly myself, have had to fight, is the story of the individuals in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in New Orleans that knew Oswald, as against the damage that de Morenschild put upon Lee Harvey Oswald. There was an article in the Houston Post about having to do with the CIA distorting our history and our facts, and de Morenschild was the kind of person who helped rearrange the facts in Dallas so that it seemed credible that Lee Harvey Oswald could even do this assassination. Next week, maybe I'll do just one whole show, hopefully, on George de Morenschild, because now the man is missing. You ought to really know who he is, and if you see anything in the newspaper this week, let me know, because I think he's the most important witness, and it's symbolic that he's missing at this time. This is Mae Brussel and Carmel. Our time is up. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy, and until then, keep well, and I'll be back with you next Monday. I think I'll be next to Monday.
Carmel.